From NPR and Futuro Media, it's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Today, the crisis in Nicaragua, where protests against the government have been met with violence.
This is something that we will remember forever. We are being part of history. We are creating and demanding democracy in our country, and we are part of this movement.
And Miguel, a conversation with the R&B Grammy Award-winning artist as he explores his Latin American roots.
My family journey has a lot to do with things like immigration, my grandmother coming here from Mexico. I would never be sitting here with you.
Plus, the LGBTQ, POC, underground 80s ball scene as portrayed in the FX series Pose. That's all coming up on Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Stay with us. No te vayas. Welcome to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. And we're going to start our show today in Nicaragua, where on April 18th of this year, the first protests began. Students went out into the streets in reaction to a new policy about Social Security. But things started escalating very quickly. Protesters were being attacked by the police and by armed groups, and they were fighting back with rocks and sticks. If you were in Nicaragua and you were at home on that day, you might not have even known that people were being attacked in the streets. And that's because news broadcasts covering the protests had been cut by the government. Instead, you might have been watching telenovelas.
¿Tantas ganas me traes?
Now, 3 months later, there are about 300 dead in clashes across the country, and the protests continue with the country in crisis. So, to begin our show, we're asking, what's the backstory and what's happening now in Nicaragua? I'm joined in the studio by Latino USA producer Saide Quevedo, who's going to help us break down exactly what's going on. So, Saide, where do you want to begin with this story about Nicaragua?
Well, to understand what's happening today, we actually have to go back a few decades. So we're going to start in 1979. Anastasio Somoza was the president of Nicaragua. He's a dictator, and his family has been in power since the 1930s. So it's about 43 or so years of Somoza rule, and by all accounts, it's a pretty brutal dictatorship.
In fact, Saide, let me give you an example. So in the mid-1970s, there was a horrible earthquake that struck Nicaragua, and people from all over the world were sending donations, and I remember there were a lot of blood donations, and later it turned out that the Somoza government had been accused of selling that blood to make money.
Yeah, and their regime is sort of just widely recognized as being pretty corrupt and pretty repressive. And in 1979, the Somoza regime was about to be overthrown by a leftist rebel group. So Somoza had started bombing his own people.
You've said, I think I'm right, that the exercise that you were engaged in was to protect the people of Nicaragua. From the outside, bombing seems a rather curious form of protection. Could you explain why you decided to do that?
To maintain the peace in the country is a way of protecting the people. Neutralizing those who break the peace is also a form of protecting the people.
In 1979, during this uprising, Victoria González Rivera was a kid.
July 1979, the news coverage on Nicaragua was daily. And we saw the bombing on TV, and we saw all the atrocities.
Victoria's parents had sent her to the U.S. to keep her safe, but they themselves were still in Nicaragua.
At that time, we didn't know whether my parents were alive or not, and that was pretty intense for a 10-year-old. unfortunately, like most Nicaraguans of my age, I have many memories like this.
And Victoria is going to help us with the history of Nicaragua leading up to now. She's a professor of Chicano studies at the University of San Diego, and she's written a bunch of books about women in politics in Nicaragua. And this insurrection that Victoria was watching on television was the world's first introduction to the FSLN, the Sandinista National Front for Liberation, or as they're commonly known, the Sandinistas.
Patria libre! Patria libre! Patria o muerte! Venceremos!
The Sandinistas were revolutionaries. They wanted to overthrow Anastasio Somoza and his regime. And they were inspired by Augusto Sandino, who was a Nicaraguan peasant revolutionary from the 1930s. And these young revolutionaries took the name of Sandino and named themselves Sandinistas. So in the name of Sandino, we are taking back our country. It was a very nationalistic and leftist revolutionary movement that actually succeeded in toppling a government.
Victoria's Sandinista rebels marched into Nicaragua's capital city of Managua today. They met only small pockets of resistance. Isolated bands of National Guardsmen they quickly overran.
And in the case of Nicaragua, the Sandinistas come to power, and they were different from other leftist revolutions, especially the main comparison was with Cuba. And the Sandinistas were way more open, way more democratic than the Cuban Revolution, and that gave a lot of people hope. And so it was very, very inspirational for many, many people.
But for Ronald Reagan, U.S. president at the time, it was a nightmare come true. He was terrified that communism was going to spread across Central America with Nicaragua as the beginning seed of that. So after the Sandinistas achieved power, the Nicaraguan right wing that was against them began to receive aid from the U.S. government. And that aid was used to form what is now known as the Contras. Right-wing paramilitary is basically like an unofficial military group specifically formed to fight against the Sandinista government.
We have an obligation to be of help where we can to freedom fighters, lovers of freedom and democracy, from Afghanistan to Nicaragua.
The way that Ronald Reagan talked about this was that communists were actually on the U.S.-Mexico border and they were prepared to flood into the United States. That was the image that Americans had, was that the communists, the Sandinistas, were ready to take over and come into the United States.
Yeah, and the Contra War, funded in part by the U.S., ended up claiming 30,000 lives. And on top of this, the U.S. ends up embargoing Nicaragua, and it was just generally like a really scary time to be in the country. And Daniel Ortega, which is a name that you should remember because it will come up again, was president at the time. He was president from 1985 until 1990. And in 1990, a ceasefire is called.
The seemingly impossible happened in Nicaragua. The Contras, mortal enemies of the Sandinista revolutionaries who dominated the country for more than 10 years, laid down their arms.
And the Sandinistas agreed to hold elections.
And they lost against Violeta Barrio de Chamorro. She won, and the FSLN peacefully turned over power.
And she says that it was actually a really big deal because this was one of the first times that a revolutionary group that had overthrown a government stepped down peacefully after losing an election. And so from then on, there were sort of various presidents from different parties and politics until 2006, when the Sandinistas won the election again with Daniel Ortega, the same one I mentioned earlier, who had served 5 years as president during the time of the revolution.
Y hemos dado ya el primer paso a llevar estos procesos electorales con mensajes que llenen de esperanza a nuestro pueblo.
And so he came in many ways to symbolize the Sandinistas for good and bad, because, of course, he had such a high profile during the revolution.
But the thing is that this second presidency was very different than the revolutionary years, because this time Ortega made alliances with right-wing politicians, he aligned himself with the Catholic Church, and his platform and his politics were just way more conservative than they had been in the past. And there were a bunch of other things that made him super unpopular. Like, there were accusations of corruption. There was this creeping nepotism. His wife, Rosario Murillo, ends up becoming vice president. And his kids go on to own or manage a number of really important media companies and advertising firms in Nicaragua. And Murillo, his wife, is in charge of government communication and actually ends up often acting as his mouthpiece. And he was also accused of molesting his stepdaughter and basically, alongside his wife, aka her mom and the vice president, convinced everyone that his stepdaughter was a pathological liar. And Ortega also changed the constitution to give himself unlimited presidential terms and purged the FSLN political party of anyone that disagreed with him.
And so the FSLN became not a minority party, because clearly, you know, there are many Nicaraguans who support Daniel even today, even after everything that has happened, but certainly one where dissent was not allowed. But then in April, things just spiraled out of control.
Coming up on Latino USA.
It is an indictment of the adults who stood around and watched, right, an unfit man hijack a party and hijack a revolution.
Stay with us. No te vayas.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and from Fifth Generation Inc., maker of 80-proof Tito's Handmade Vodka, distilled from corn and naturally gluten-free. Recipes and more at titosvodka.com. Distilled and bottled in Austin, Texas. And the ECMC Foundation, working to improve post-secondary educational outcomes for underserved students through evidence-based innovation. Learn more at ecmcfoundation.org.
Welcome back to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. And when we left off, producer Zaire Quevedo was telling us about how the recent protests in Nicaragua got started. We were also joined by historian Victoria González Rivera. And Zaire, exactly what happened in April to make things begin to spiral out of control?
So it's two things. First is that back in 2013, Daniel Ortega, the president of Nicaragua, made a deal with a company based out of Hong Kong called HKND, the Hong Kong-Nicaragua Canal Development Investment Company. And basically, what he did was he granted them a 50-year concession to build and operate a canal in Nicaragua. For years, China has wanted a canal to compete with the Panama Canal. But there was no transparency around this. He granted the company rights over any land that they chose, even land that was already owned by private citizens. And the company was also permitted to sell the rights of the canal to whoever they chose.
And this is a really big deal, because what Daniel Ortega was allowing the Chinese to do was essentially slice the country in half.
And it was an even bigger deal that he hadn't consulted with anyone in the country about this. They found out about it after the fact. And then the second thing. So this year, Ortega proposed major Social Security reforms. The changes increased the amount paid into the Social Security system by workers and employers, but reduced the pensions of retired workers. So basically what that means is that people would be paying more into the Social Security system, but be receiving less benefits when they retire. It's meant to boost Social Security in the country because it's in a deficit right now. And so these protests start in response to the Social Security reforms. But they're also about all of these other things that have just kind of added up over time. In this video from the first day of the protest, you can see some young people at the National University. They're standing around, some of them have signs in their hand, and then suddenly, everyone starts to run. And these Ortega supporters have started hurling rocks at them, and they're wearing white shirts, and one of them is holding what looks like a big stick. You know, around the same time, there's this wave of anti-corruption protests all over the region, in Honduras, in Guatemala. And that's all to say that, you know, these kind of protests were normal, but what wasn't normal is what happened next. The police response was aggressive. They used rubber bullets and tear gas against peaceful protesters, and the situation quickly escalated. In another video from the same day, a young man lays bloodied on the street with a crowd around him. According to the person who uploaded the video, he's a university student who was shot dead by the police. Even though these protests started out about the canal and Social Security, police brutality became the focal point of people's anger. More protests started breaking out. In some videos, another presence begins to emerge. Sometimes they're wearing motorcycle helmets. Often they're wearing shirts with government or Sandinista slogans on them. And they're almost always in groups. In the videos, they're described as turbas, or mobs. And they're attacking journalists and activists at the marches. These are members of pro-Ortega groups that start showing up at the protests. In this video, you can see the march passing by. This guy is taking photos off on the side, and a mob of pro-Ortega people grab the camera, throw it on the floor, and just start punching him. In her daily briefing to The Nation, Rosario Murillo, the vice president and Ortega's wife, had this to say about the protesters.
Qué tristeza da la manipulación política de los mismos de siempre. Esos minúsculos grupos que asusan y desestabilizan para destruir Nicaragua.
She says, how sad. We're seeing the same political manipulation from the same people as always. These tiny groups that inflame and destabilize in order to destroy Nicaragua. By the end of the week, nearly 27 people were dead. It was a level of violence against protesters that hadn't been seen in the country for decades. Ortega withdrew the proposal for Social Security reforms a few days later, but also said that if protesters didn't stop, that he would take measures to regain peace in the country, which sounded to a lot of folks like a veiled threat. Protests continued, and by the second week, students had taken one of the universities, and by the first month, barricades had begun to pop up across the country. In a speech on July 7th given at a rally, Daniel Ortega compares the protesters and those who support them to Cain from the Bible, killing their brothers. He calls them sowers of hate, terrorists, and killers.
Los que financian, los que estimulan, los que justifican estos crímenes, asesinos, asesinos.
Over time, protesters begin to use these homemade weapons, and then at the same time, pro-Ortega mobs in the streets become more militant, and they begin to evolve. Like, you remember I was describing them before, and they were wearing the motorcycle helmets, and they're carrying sticks? Well, now you see them, and they're decked out in military fatigues, and they have automatic weapons, and people start referring to them as paramilitaries.
And then the paramilitaries will often travel with the police. And so that's how you know that they're linked, they're affiliated with the police, is because they're right there and they see armed men with ski masks and they don't do anything about it. They all get into the same vehicles and they're all, you know, in the same places at the same time, right? Shooting at the same people.
Remember, these protests started in April, so that's nearly 3 months ago. And something to keep in mind is that this is a super messy situation, and much of the information we have comes from videos uploaded to YouTube and social media. And it can be really hard to verify information. But it's estimated that clashes between protesters and police or pro-Ortega supporters have resulted in around 300 dead. The vast majority of the dead are protesters, but some police and paramilitary members have died as well. On July 15th, anti-Ortega protesters held a general strike, and student protesters who had taken the National University were attacked as pro-Ortega groups shot into a church on the campus, where students had barricaded themselves in. Two people reportedly were killed. In this video, a young woman hides behind a barricade at the National University during the attack. She's crying as shots ring out in the background.
Mama! Mama, perdóname! Salí a defender mi patria! Te amo, ¿viste?
She records the video as if it's her last moment, like it's a final message. She says, "Mom, please forgive me. I came here to defend my country." According to reports, the young woman from this video, Valeska Sandoval, went missing a few days after the attack.
Oh, this is just so sad. And the thing that makes this conflict different than a lot of other Latin American political stories, in fact, even Nicaragua from just 35 years ago, is that this is no longer a typical left versus right kind of conflict.
No, exactly. So like the left is split and there are these different factions, right? So there are students and protesters who believe Daniel Ortega is authoritarian and needs to go, and they see themselves as the left. But then we also have what are called Danielistas, people who are in support of Daniel Ortega, and they also see themselves as the left, as continuing the Sandinista revolution. And there are other Danielistas as well who say that the protesters are actually part of a right-wing conspiracy to overthrow the government. And that seems to be the way the government sees it as well, which, given the history of U.S. intervention in Central America and Nicaragua specifically, is kind of an understandable conspiracy theory.
So the people who support Daniel Ortega, they say that they're part of the left, but so do the people who are trying to overthrow him.
Yeah, and Victoria says that those on the right feel like this is basically just proof of what they already knew.
Saying, see, look, we knew all along that the FSLN was bad. We knew all along that communism was bad. We knew all along that socialism was bad. We would have been better if we had just stayed with Somoza.
In Victoria's personal opinion, it's not an indictment of the left.
It is an indictment of the adults who stood around and watched, right, an unfit man hijack a party and hijack a revolution that then left entire generations at his mercy.
And for Victoria, it's especially difficult because she's watching everything that's going down in her home country from afar, through the shaky lens of Facebook Live videos.
I am absolutely heartbroken. Just speechless. Every single day I get hundreds of texts and emails and phone calls from blood relatives, friends, telling me live what's happening. Many of them are on hit lists, you know, kill lists.
Once people are on the list, they're less likely to protest, and especially those who have families to support don't want to be targeted, don't want something to happen to them. But Victoria says that even with the kill lists and armed opposition, young people are still going out and protesting. We spoke to one of those protesters, and she asked to not have her name revealed because of the potential danger it could cause her. She fears she could be targeted by the paramilitaries. She was a student and a teacher before the protests started, and she says that honestly before, she, like many people, had basically given up hope of the government changing. But after seeing people taking the streets, she felt motivated to do something. She started organizing with her friends over social media, and now she spends her time bringing supplies like medicine and water to protesters and demanding for the release of those who've been arrested.
This is something that we will remember forever. We are being part of history. We are creating and demanding democracy in our country, and we are part of this movement. It's something that we will tell our children and grandchildren.
At the same time, she says it's bittersweet because she grew up hearing stories from her parents and her grandparents about the Sandinista revolution, the one they fought for alongside Daniel Ortega. And she says now they're fighting against Ortega, against the same repression all over again.
need the world, we need United States, we need every person to know what is really happening here. This is not a war. We don't have guns. We don't have anything that they are using against us. They are following us. They are chasing us. And they are killing us.
At least 309 demonstrators have been confirmed dead, according to a report presented July 17th by the Nicaraguan Association for Human Rights. More than 1,500 have been injured. And the young woman from that video that we mentioned earlier, Valeska Sandoval, was located and released. Her detention was not acknowledged by the government.
Saide, thank you so much for all of your reporting on this.
Thank you, Maria.
Thanks to Victoria González Rivera for your help with this story. And now, we're going to shift gears in a big way and dive into the world of music. Miguel rose to prominence as an R&B singer. His name is actually Miguel Pimentel, and you know him as a Grammy Award-winning artist from L.A. He's the son of an African-American mother and an immigrant father born in Zamora, Michoacán, in Mexico. He's often been compared to Prince for his eclectic sound, which draws from a wide range of musical currents.
Hello, stranger, it's been a minute since we last kicked it.
Miguel is getting more and more acclaim, and at the same time, he's increasingly embracing his Latino roots. Last year, the hit movie Coco featured a version of the song Remember Me, which Miguel sang with Mexican pop singer Natalia Lafourcade. Miguel performed the song earlier this year at the Oscars. This year, he'll be releasing a deluxe version of his album War and Leisure, which will include some of his songs in Spanish. The project was inspired by a recent trip to Zamora, Michoacán, which is the town where Miguel's dad was born. And there, for the first time, Miguel finally met his family in Mexico. Miguel joins me now to talk about his life-changing trip to Mexico and how his mixed-race upbringing influenced his sound. Miguel, it's so great to have you on Latino USA.
It's a pleasure to be here.
So tell me about growing up. I mean, everybody knows Miguel, the artist. I want to try to understand a little bit about how you were growing up. And I've been thinking a lot about my own experience. So like, you know, my family was fully Mexican growing up in Chicago, but my parents' best friends were African-American.
Well, I mean, that's, I guess, a crazy parallel because I grew up in a Black and Mexican kind of part of San Pedro, which is a smaller part of Los Angeles.
So who are you living with when you're growing up?
Mostly my mother. My father fought as hard as he possibly could to spend as much time as he possibly could with my brother and I. And he drove out from Inglewood over the weekends, every other weekend to visit us. He picked us up, dropped us off. We saw him over the summertime. He's an educator. He's a teacher.
Is that why you know Spanish?
Well, yeah, because in the summertime, I was with my nana and my tata.
So nana and tata are
my father's parents.
Okay.
And so all of my tías and tíos, my uncles and my aunts, kids, my cousins, we stayed with my grandparents in the summertime while our parents in Inglewood.
In Inglewood. So y'all were just like doing
family
the Mexican summertime.
Yeah, there we go.
Oh my God, it must have been
my favorite.
What did you guys
summertime,
do every
man.
Day?
Because my father was a teacher, he also was off in the summertime. So we spent, man, summers were the best with my dad. The best. Some of my most fond memories going to the beach, Venice Beach, we're there all the time.
And I love the fact that I see a lot of people of color, a lot of Mexicanos out there with the whole family.
You already know. Yep. It was beautiful. I mean, still is beautiful energy in Venice. But not only that, because sometimes my father taught summer school, so a lot of time with my nana, lots of MTV, lots of puzzles with my tata, and board games with my grandfather, my tata.
What board games?
Man, we played Trouble. We played Uno. And he would like, sometimes we didn't want to play, but by force he'd be like, no, we're going to play. Some of my favorite memories, man, playing board games and doing puzzles with my grandfather.
Did you start singing like when you were three? Or
I was always singing. That was kind of the part of it. It was like, I was the kid that everyone knew that I was going to do something. I was always singing, dancing, performing.
But like at three? Yeah. Like at how
early? Early, yeah, early on.
Like two?
Yeah, as soon as I could dance, as soon as I could use my legs, it was like, you know, singing, dancing, all of these things, yeah.
Are you kidding?
At our family parties type thing.
You were when just we were like, around, oh, mira, ahí viene Miguel.
Yeah, well, dance. It was like, come on, Miguel. They called me Mikey when I was younger. You know, I loved Michael Jackson growing up, so I was, you know, getting my Michael Jackson moves in, and that was the thing. You know, at family parties, family gatherings, that's what I was doing. Put the music on. Come on, dance, Mikey.
Do you remember, like, your first memories of music?
Early memories with music. I mean, being in Los Angeles, car drives, car rides and music, that's where we got it in. I remember my mom driving me to school early. For some reason, my vivid memories with music and my mother come from, like, fifth grade.
So what were you listening to when your mom was driving you to school?
Those car rides were, like, soul music, a lot of classic stuff, you know, a lot of Temptations. And then all the R&B stuff at the time, you know, Anita Baker. Hope you see that you can lean on me.
And she was singing and you were too?
Absolutely.
In the car?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Or she would go, what instrument is playing this part?
Oh,
yeah.
Cool.
Me and my brother, which was really cool.
And then when your dad was driving?
That could be anything. That could be some 80s rap. It might be the Fugees. I remember my father was playing, had the Fugees tape. The Score, that very first album, The Score by the Fugees.
Do you remember singing along to any of those songs?
And the cover that Lauren did of, it's early and I'm not going to remember song names right now.
That's okay.
But, whoa, I've heard he sang a good song.
Oh, wait.
I heard he had a style.
Roberta Flack.
Mm-hmm. And when I came to see him, and so I came to see him and listen for a while. And there he was, this young one, I stained it to my eyes, strumming my pain with
killing
his finger.
Softly.
There we go. Singing my life
with his words. Coming up on Latino USA, my conversation with Miguel continues. Stay with us, no te vayas.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and from the Jack Kent Cook Foundation, providing scholarships throughout the nation to exceptionally high-achieving students with financial need from middle school to college. More information about Cook scholarships is available at jkcf.org. And Carnegie Corporation of New York, supporting innovations in education, democratic engagement, and the advancement of international peace and security. More information is available online at carnegie.org.
Welcome back to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa, and I'm speaking with Grammy Award-winning R&B singer Miguel. And before the break, Miguel painted a picture of his childhood, growing up in Los Angeles. But now, we're going to talk about Miguel's first ever visit to Mexico with the Viceland series Earthworks.
How does it happen? Like, somebody from Vice basically calls you up?
Man, the opportunity was this. We were picking artists that they thought were interesting and, you know, had a perspective to choose a place in the world to go. I could have chose anywhere, but I was like, I want to go to Zamora. I want to go to Michoacan. And can I take my father? And can I go with my brother as well? Can I bring them? And they were like, yeah, even better.
Most people think of me solely as a black artist, but there's a reason why my name is Miguel. My father's from Mexico, and in search for a better life, he and his family came to the U.S. before I was born. So until now, I haven't been able to come back.
And so that was the whole thing. You know, I wanted it to be about family, kind of a family discovery, and also to learn about, you know, where my family's from.
So what was the thing, like, when you think back on that trip into Michoacan, what's the thing that you're like, that moment?
Oh, dinner with family.
I wondered if you were a little dizzy. It was so much hugging and food and laughter and the smile on your face.
Yeah, it's a great memory.
No importa donde, si tenías familia allí, the feeling is the same. If we know each other or not.
Nos conocemos o no.
And I only know that because I'm here now.
Yeah.
So then you go to the radio station where your grandmother used to sing?
Yeah.
Saludotes, bienvenidos. Tenemos para usted una enorme sorpresa. Miguel Pimentel, quien tiene el gusto por la música ahora. Bueno, pues mire, la historia.
When she was much younger, before she was with my grandfather, her and her sister and their friend, I believe, sang on, they were like a trio on the radio.
Mm-hmm. I mean, at that moment, did you feel like this deep connection to your family?
Yes, my grandmother is the real root. You start to take a look at the journey and the sacrifice and all of that, and that just feels like you are rooted in a much bigger picture, in a bigger story, in a bigger thing than yourself.
I want to take a listen to a Los Panchos song that you covered along with your dad and your brother in a tribute to her.
Sin ti no podré vivir jamás y pensar que nunca más estarás junto a mí. Sin ti, ¿qué me puede importar si lo que me hace llorar?
You're now about to do a whole album in Spanish.
Yeah. So War and Leisure is my latest album. I've re-recorded the majority of the album in Spanish. And so this will be my very first Spanish release.
So tell me about your decision to record some of your songs in Spanish, because that is not easy. That's really hard, actually.
It's challenging to translate lyric and to keep it within the theme of the song. The awesome thing was that the songs are better and more poetic in Spanish. So the very first single is a song called Banana Clip.
¿Cómo va la canción en español? Más o menos.
No va a matar el amor. Sin control, ah, mortal, no. Y todo esto lo hago por ti, si me lo pides, y yo disparo.
La pasión letal no va a matarnos, no puedo confiar, ya ves, nos encontramos. Tú y yo, los dos, tocando el cielo, el amor.
I gotta say, I love watching you and hearing you speak Spanish.
It's going to happen more con tiempo, como es práctica. Es importante para hablar con más gente. Y eso es el, that's the goal.
La meta.
La meta.
Love the word meta in Spanish. It's such a great word.
Yeah, meta.
Too proper for the black kids. Too black for the Mexicans. Too square to be a hood. What's normal anyway?
being Mexican and being Black is really a challenge in this country. You have a huge platform, right? Do you feel this, like, particular pressure? Dude, I am Black and I am Mexican in this particular moment, and I'm an artist.
I feel an opportunity. By chance, I happen to be both, and I can identify with both. So it's beautiful. My family journey has a lot to do with things like immigration. You know what I mean? And my grandmother coming here from Mexico. I would never be sitting here with you. It would have never happened without my grandmother being an immigrant, you know?
I never feel like I belong. Miguel, it's been such a pleasure spending some time with you.
The pleasure's mine. It's a pleasure to share, you know, a bit of where I come from and get to talk about the music that's coming, you know? I'm excited about it, so thank you.
Nosotros también. We're very excited. Gracias, Miguel.
Igualmente. Gracias, gracias, gracias.
That was singer and songwriter Miguel Pimentel. The song Banana Clip in Spanish is out August 3rd. His album will be available later this year. We're going to end our show this week by speaking with two actresses who are opening doors in television. Pose, a new hit series on FX, is telling the stories of the dazzling 1980s underground ball scene. It was a subculture of LGBTQ people of color who competed among each other in dance, drag, and so-called realness performances. They created a safe space to be themselves in the process. Pose is directed by Ryan Murphy of Nip Tuck, Glee, and American Horror Story fame. It's making television history by featuring the largest cast of transgender actors on television ever, as well as the largest recurring cast of LGBTQ actors for a scripted series. The show covers topics like body politics, race, class, sex, love, and HIV, and MJ Rodriguez stars in Pose as Blanca. She becomes a house mother who's basically like the leader of a self-selected family for rejected LGBTQ youth. And India Moore plays Angel. She's one of Blanca's house children, and she's a sex worker who develops feelings for her cisgender straight white client. India Moore.
Yes,
and
ma'am.
MJ Rodriguez.
Yes, mommy.
Welcome to Latino USA.
Hello, hello.
Hello.
So can you just kind of describe that, like, underground ball scene? I mean, a lot of people are like, what's a ball? So can you just kind of paint the picture for people who may not know?
I feel like the ballroom scene is a place of refuge for people who feel like they don't have any other place to go when they don't have anyone understanding them, especially a marginalized people who are of the Latino and Latina and African-American experience and of the trans experience, of the LGBT experience. I think that's a place where people find space to be who they are. When there was, at that time, when there was no space for them, they went there to live out their true fantasies and also their realities.
So what exactly is a ball?
Balls are a gathering of people who are not welcome to gather anywhere else. A celebration of a life that the rest of the world does not deem worthy of celebration. There are categories. People dress up for them. Walk. There's voting, trophies.
Oh, can you make money?
Better than money. You can actually make a name for yourself by winning a trophy or two.
Can you take me, MJ, to the first time you remember walking into, whether it was La Escuelita or another place? Like, what did you feel?
When,
yeah.
The first time I got to experience and feel my community, that feeling was accepting. It was warm. It was a place where, like I said, I felt most comfortable. And I saw people who looked like me. I saw people who looked like me outside of the ballroom scene. Obviously, I saw a lot of women who looked like me. But I saw a marginalized people, especially women, of a different vernacular and of a different experience like me. It just felt like home.
So that rejection that people feel, is that basically what leads to the creation of houses?
You ever consider joining a house?
What do you mean?
Well, a house is the family. You get to choose. I'm a house mother. I provide a support system for my children and housing if you need it. Together we can beat in the balls of town. And, you know, I've been looking to adopt a child with your dance. Mm-hmm.
So a lot of people hear that and they're just like, wait. Can you explain that to people who are just like, wait a second, you have a house and a chosen family. Didn't you have a house and a family already?
Oh, yeah. I can definitely see how it's like alien to people to see trans people and like LGBTQ people of color making space to love one another, being that like we exist in a society that tells us that we don't deserve that and we're not meant to be loved existentially. I think like when you've been deprived of everything that you need to identify with yourself, you just become what you need. And that's what we have done as marginalized people of color, but also as gay, bi, and trans people and queer people. You know, we've essentially became the family that we've needed and the love that we needed. We've created spaces to provide that to one another.
You know, on the show, there's a lot of this like falling in line or realness. So what exactly is that about?
So, I mean, it's also one of the categories in the ballroom scene.
The category is realness. Bring it like a weather girl. Who will show us whether it will be rain or shine? Who is real enough to be on Channel 9?
Something that a lot of women walk, and it can also be a detrimental category to walk.
The category used to be for the juicy girls, but not tonight.
Because it also, like India said, it can be a way to try to enforce what a woman is supposed to look like. Mm-hmm. And sometimes that encourages women of the ballroom scene to go to black market surgeries and get injections like silicone. And it's only important and it's imperative to show things like that because it's a realistic aspect of what we go through and how the social construct is put upon us on how we are supposed to look like and how we are supposed to be as women when all we have to do is just simply be. And it affects a lot of women in the ballroom scene, and sometimes it makes them become addictive to it. And the realness aspect of it can be a little detrimental. You know what I mean? And a lot of women in the ballroom scene, they wanted to get their quick fix. And with those quick fixes, sometimes they came fatalities.
So tell me what it's like to work on a show that is so trans, queer, gay, POC centered.
It's creating a narrative that should have already been created. I think it's shedding a light on a community that has always been needed to be uplifted and hasn't gotten the time to be uplifted, and now there's a time for it. And I'm happy to have that responsibility because my main goal is to bridge the gap between different communities so that we don't have to be a stigma anymore. And if people do get an understanding of these are human experiences and that we bleed the same blood as anyone else, then it'll help them move on through life. And maybe we can work together to change some other things.
Do you think that's why the show is resonating with people who are not trans?
Well, like with realness, for example, this is something that anybody could relate with because like cis people who are black and brown are like pressured to adhere to like whiteness in a sense, to like be successful for anything from the way, you know, we speak, you know what I mean? To like the way we dress ourselves, the way we wear our hair, you know, like skin bleaching, like browner tone people are like made to feel like darker skin isn't good enough. You know, like you have to adhere to this standard to be successful, to be seen, to be noticed. That's something I feel like that we all can relate with, like feeling pressured to like subscribe to another culture that is foreign to us and us being not good enough.
Is there someone, MJ, who when you're on set and you're acting that you are modeling after, that you're thinking about?
Yes, I do have someone
you
in
do.
Mind.
You do, I know. You immediately were like, yep, who mm-hmm. is that?
It's my mother. My mother was a big person, a big, strong, sturdy figure in my life. And yes, I bring other aspects of things that I went through, different techniques, but the main and focal point is my mother. She raised me well. She's still here, and she's still raising me, even though she don't know it. And I take all of her, if not all, most of her, to the scenes that I have because there has to be some aspect of reality to acting. You can't just pull anything. We're storytellers more so than anything. And if I want the world to see what a nurturing mother is, I have to pull from something that is the truth. And that was my mama.
So, you know, MJ, I gotta say, you know, you do play a house mom on the show, but I've just been watching what's been going on here in the studio. It's like you are a mom to India.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, you look the same age, but you know.
But as her stage mom, but also as like outside of that, as her sister, I just want to keep encouraging her to be the most powerful woman that she is. Not only is she intelligent, but she is beautiful and she is strong and she stands for something. And I hope that you send a message to all these young people out here. They're looking at you. They're looking at you from Teen Vogue. They're looking at you from 14 and all the way into 22. You are literally the future. You are the future, and people are going to look at you and they're going to see you in full fruition.
Mm. Thank you.
You're welcome.
And Indy, I'm just wondering, do you want to say something about that?
First of all, MJ is one of the most charming people that I know. And
she's wicked smart.
Is so, oh my God.
She's so smart.
It's just affirming for me to like be able to have the privilege to work with and also know other trans women who are like constantly challenging everything and also being an example for others, like in challenging all the things that we're socialized to believe.
MJ and India, thank you so much for coming to Latino USA. This has been beautiful. Thank you so much.
Of course, of course, of course.
Thank you so much. God bless you.
Thank you.
The season finale of Pose just aired, and the show was just renewed for a second season. That's it for today. Latino USA is produced by Miguel Macias, Antonia Cerejido, Andres Caballero, Maggie Freeling, Janice Yamoka, and Sayer Quevedo, with help from Fernanda Chavarri. We're edited by Marlon Bishop and Sofia Paliza Carr. Our engineers are Gini Montalvo and Stephanie Lebeau. Our production manager is Natalia Fidelholz. Our fellows are Virginia Lora and Jesse Alejandro Cottrell. Our theme music was composed by Zenia Rubinos. And if you like the music that you heard, stop by latinousa.org and check out our weekly Spotify playlist. Also, my dear listener, I want to tell you about something really exciting. This year, Latino USA turns 25. And on Sunday, August 12th in New York City, we're teaming up with the City Park Summer Stage to celebrate with Grammy winner Jerry Rivera, New Yorican poet La Bruja, and percussionist Chembo Corniel. Come out and party with the Latino USA team in New York City's East River Park, and I'll see you there. I'm your host and executive producer, Maria Hinojosa. Join us again on the next episode, and in the meantime, look for us on all of your social media. Ciao!
Latino USA is made possible in part by Heising Simons Foundation, unlocking knowledge, opportunity, and possibilities. More at hsfoundation.org. Winecoat Foundation, and with support from the Rockefeller Brothers Fund.
Mexicans love Michael Jackson.
I mean, everyone loved Michael Jackson.
Everyone loved Michael Jackson, but that's true.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and from the Ewing Marion Kauffman Foundation, offering Kauffman Fast Track, a program which provides insights, templates, and guides to help aspiring entrepreneurs start businesses. More online at fasttrac.org. And the estate of Branna and Irving Sissonwein, supporting the collaborative news gathering model of NPR and member station newsrooms, which seek to create a network that reflects and illuminates the fabric of America. This is NPR.